Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Failing Up. I'm Guy.
I'm Eden.
And thank you again for joining us in Eden's beautiful home.
Thank you.
So, any fails this week, Eden, that you could think of?
Anything? Oh, I have one.
Your brain?
Yes.
Okay.
This is a big fail. This happened today. I know. Well, I found out today it's a fail.
Okay.
So, I met this guy through that weird app.
Right, the celebrity.
I'm on the celebrity dating app, which I should not be on. One, because I don't like dating through the computer. And two, I'm not a celebrity. So I don't think I qualify.
You're verified on Twitter. That's good enough.
It's fine. So I had this guy was messaging me, and he seemed cool and a tribesman. And I was like, oh, that's nice. And he gave me his number. And I was like, cool. And he was texting me a little yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I asked him where he was from, L.A. But I don't give people especially when you're dating someone new,
right?
I don't give them a name in my phone until I know they're gonna be in my life, because mm-hmm. I feel like that's, you know. I
so
don't know.
He's like dude from the app.
No, he's not. He's just a number.
Oh,
he's just 310. Blah 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 blah.
Okay.
So I asked him a question like, "Where did you go to high school? Because you're from LA." And he never responded. But later that day, he was like, "Hey, I don't mean to be a flake, but I can't. I have to leave to New York on Monday." So, but I'm sure a pretty girl like yourself will find something to entertain yourself on Sunday night. And I was like, oh, and he was flirty and kept on chatting. And I'm like, oh, don't worry, I don't get out much. Just let me know when you're back.
Right.
today I was like, I was supposed to have a date tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, where's that guy that was supposed to, different, not the same guy from the app, different
okay.
guy. I was like, where's that guy? And I realized they both have 310 numbers.
Uh-oh.
And I thought the Raya guy was the one that was like, oh, sorry to be a flake, which I thought was weird. Anyway, basically.
You don't have a date tonight.
I need to start giving people names in my phone. That's a long story. So now I change their names, and now it's Michael from Raya or James yeah. from blah, blah, blah. So.
I had a fail this week, Eden.
Okay.
And involved you. I don't think I should say the specifics of it.
Okay.
Just for my own edification. I texted you something this week by mistake that I was supposed to text to somebody else.
Oh, yeah. You were like, you know how you text someone by accident?
Yes.
And you're like, oops, sorry, wrong text. And, you know, you want to say something really gross and mean.
One time my friend was being a dick and I went to go text another friend. I'm like, Paul's being such a dick. He's like, still me. I'm like, fuck. Yeah, so I kind of did something like that with you. I was trying to tell somebody else my.
You also flaked on Jay Duplass, so.
I did. It's been a crazy week.
Yeah.
It really has.
Okay.
So now that we've yapped for a good 5 minutes,
yeah. Sorry about that, everybody.
Let's introduce. Do you want to introduce our guest? You want me to
yes.
introduce our guest?
Okay. All right. We have Ben Lee here today. How are you?
I am good. How are
good.
You? Thanks for having me, guys.
Ben, you're. Even your Wikipedia says you're an actor and a musician, right?
I acted in second grade in Uncle Moishe and His Mitzvah Men.
Yes. Who did you musical. Play, though?
I was Uncle Moishe.
Oh, we'll see. So then, that's
you
actually
I sang a great song called Ain't Gonna Work on Saturday.
You should still
double, thinking. Double, triple pay, Ain't Gonna Work on Saturday. No, and then I don't... Wikipedia, you can't control it, right? I never looked
actually,
at it.
Actually, I just learned you can. And I technically, they let me be an editor.
Oh.
So I can do it now.
Well, I'm not an... I acted once in a movie.
Yeah.
Because I got asked to. But I'm certainly not an actor. I'm a musician.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
So anyway. So who does your Wikipedia then? That's a good question.
I don't know. I thought it was sort of a public...
I'm going to go fix it.
I feel like some people, they do it themselves.
No, they don't. They can't.
Do it themselves. And then...
I've
definitely seen people that... I've read something like, yeah, that's just something I told my publicist.
The Wikipedia
there,
people asked me to do this event for them. I mm-hmm. don't know why they asked me, but they asked me to come to this Wiki Women event.
Okay.
They wanted a bunch of women writers to come, and I did it, and I learned, they actually, you can't have any affiliation with who you're editing.
Huh.
So you can't be that person.
That's kind of weird.
And you have to Wikipedia has to verify if you're an editor, who you are.
Yeah.
And then they do research on you. So I tried to edit other, all my friends and write they're badass or some shit.
Yeah.
But I can't.
Okay, so immediate question. One of the first things I see about you is you were born on September 11th.
Yes.
I mean, I hate to be this person, but your birthday kind of is a bummer now, no?
Well, it's funny. I mean, it's interesting. Also, Moby, his birthday is September 11th. Mm-hmm. My friend Sally Saltman, she's a musician in Australia. But, yes, I lived in New York during when that happened, September 11th. And I remember the year after. I was just like my girlfriend at the time was like, oh, are you going to do anything? I was like, it's just too weird.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, I can't do anything. And I left it, and everyone kept asking me. And it was like a really weird day, the first anniversary after, you know, September 11th. And then I remember it was like 6 p.m. and I was like, I'm just going to have some friends over for some drinks.
Yeah. Right.
And I started calling friends. They were like, thank God. Like, something. It's been such a horrible day. Let's think about something else. So... But yeah, it's one of those funny things. Like, people look at you as if you were involved because it was your birthday. Where you go, like you go, they say, what's your birthday? You say, September 11th. They're like, ooh. Like, what are you looking at me like suspiciously? I was born, you know, whatever it was, 25 years before.
Right. I know.
Nothing to do with me.
I promise you, pure coincidence.
It's scary when I meet kids who don't know what it was like, who were born after.
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa. And they're like, how was that day? And I'm like, I remember that.
Yeah.
So weird.
I have a 6-year-old niece who just realized that I didn't have internet when I was a kid and that my parents didn't have TV when they were kids. Like, blew her freaking mind. Like,
oh, yeah.
Let alone September 11th. Forget it. That's coming down the road.
She'll learn.
Yeah. Horrible. Oh, did you see that?
I saw the fly.
The fly landed on the board, but I hit him.
I know.
And he just moved a little bit, and he's still there.
He was like a combating more than threatened.
When they say, wouldn't hurt a fly, I guess that comes down to me. Dude, I don't want to kill him, but...
That's so you. You are so, like, this gentle Jew that will not, like, hurt a fly. And this fly won't budge.
He knows it. What a dick.
He's like, this
guy... I feel insulted a little bit. Like,
yeah, you're a pussy.
That's you wouldn't hurt a fly. Is telling me. All right, that's it. No, I'm just kidding. He flew away. So, okay, so we've gotten past September 11th. Horrible day. I'm from New Jersey. I moved here in April of 2001. So, like, right before...
Oh, you did?
Went down.
I was suspicious.
Yeah, I know.
But, no, I used to take a train into the city and come out at the World Trade Center and walk to Broadway to take classes to be a day trader, to take my Series 7 test and stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, I literally would walk out of those buildings and just look up and go, whoa, look how big these things are. Like, marvel at just the size. Now, they weren't the most beautiful buildings. Everybody kind of, you know, they were two rectangles. But, yeah, what a horrible loss, a horrible day, and all that stuff. So back to Ben.
Yeah.
You were what, 13, 14 when you realized you wanted to be a musician? Well, did you know before that?
Yeah, I think earlier than that. I think probably by about 10 years old, I wanted to be in a rock band. That was something just very clear to me.
Yeah.
And then when I was 14, that was I'd seen Nirvana play January 92. And it really was one of those, it's funny, like I sort of had this very distilled experience of understanding punk rock. It was going, oh, that is like, because before that I'd seen like, you know, Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue and these things that were like very over the top.
Right.
And then when I saw Nirvana play, I was like, oh, that's three guys standing on a stage playing songs. Like, it suddenly became incredibly doable, which is like the entire lesson of DIY and punk rock, like, was summed up in that experience. And I started a band like the next day.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you remember when you're like, when you are 10 years old, what was the impetus? Were you watching? I mean, like I said, I have a 6-year-old niece. She's like, I want to be a rock star, but she probably doesn't really want to be a rock star.
She probably does.
Well, maybe. It's possible. I feel like that's just a buzzword for kids at this point. But was there a band other than before Nirvana? Was there a performance that you saw? What was the first concert you went to?
Yeah, I mean, the first, when I was 10, I saw Motley Crue play on the Dr. Feel Good Tour. And they were my favorite.
Wow. Who took you to that?
My dad.
That's awesome.
Your dad is awesome.
My dad took me and my two best friends at the time. And it was, it was incredible. It's funny. I think a lot of it is about sex, especially when you're like prepubescent, like the kind of music it's so horrible, the messages. I think I'm like still deprogramming myself from like 5 or 6 years of listening to like hard rock and glam metal and stuff, you know. But yeah, I don't know. I think at a deeper level there was, you know, some musical blood in my family. My great uncle was the court violinist for Tsar Nicholas in Russia.
Yeah.
I had another uncle who was a gypsy violinist in Berlin in the 20s. Like, there was this sort of like gypsy, kind of Jewish gypsy troubadour music thing in our family. And it appealed to me. It appealed to me that, like, when I, obviously it's easy to make fun of like Motley Crue and, you know, bands like that. But I think at the end of the day, I always liked that, like, this loud music could sort of shake people up.
Yeah.
And I still like now, even if I'm listening to a singer-songwriter or classical music or anything, I like that feeling where you just sort of get shaken up and your worldview is suddenly blown open.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I think what I was always attracted to was really, like, the transformative nature of music.
Yeah.
And the fact that it can actually affect you in this really primal way.
Yeah.
And that for me was what it was about, kind of standing on a stage and helping create that kind of a moment for an audience.
First of all, how cool is your dad, like Evan said?
Yeah,
like,
I'm just thinking. My mom gave me a hard time going to the Spice Girls concert.
I saw my first concert was Paul McCartney at 13, but I'm a big Pearl Jam fan, and one of my close friends, he's taken his kids to see Pearl Jam shows since they were like 5, 6 years old. Kind of thing. Evan's like, oh, that's terrible. That's child abuse. No, it was, it's actually pretty cool, like, now to see them as they're older and like. It's a huge experience. Like, my parents are foreigners and all that stuff. They would have never thought to take me to a Motley Crue show.
Like, well, I mean, I begged. I wanted to go to that concert. My dad says,
"How do you?" That's
That's what we were into, me and my friends. Yeah. You know, it was that time. It was, you know, whatever.
Dr. Feelgood,
late '80s, early '90s.
Yeah.
Motley
Crue.
Yeah, it was really funny though. I remember like listening to Dr. Feelgood exactly a lot, like leading up to the concert, and my dad just sort of mindlessly singing along in the car. And I always remember my dad driving along going, "She goes down, she goes down, she goes down, 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 down." And just feeling like this is so uncomfortable.
Right.
Because it wasn't like he wasn't tapped into, he was just singing along.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I already had figured it told out by a friend what that was about.
Okay.
And it was very awkward. Yeah.
I was going to ask how you figured that out, because I remember at 10, somebody said to me, "Did you see this guy? He had a bag of grass." And I thought he was walking around with lawn clippings in his hand. Like, I would never have gotten that. She goes down at 10 years old or 11.
Well, you know, you start asking questions.
Yeah, I guess you have that one friend. Yeah, exactly. That one friend that's like, "No, it means this." You're like, "Oh my God. Dad, did you know?" That's what I do. My parents still, you know, they're so behind the times that I still teach them, you know, those kind of things.
I remember my sister, she would go to midnight screenings of Rocky Horror at like 15. And my parents were like into that, which was weird.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, "Yeah, go play like you're a transvestite on stage in front of people and you can't even drive yet." But, you know, going to see Spice Girls live was, you know, at
forbidden.
9 was not for, well, she just was like, "I don't know if this is right."
Yeah. Well, it's sort of funny how certain types of transgressive art do become safe in some way. And for whatever reason, your parents kind of understood that Rocky Horror experience, or it had sort of become normalized to them.
Yeah.
Whereas things that, it's interesting now when I listen to certain kinds of, like, you know, like, say, like Tyler, the Creator, like my stepdaughter really loves him, and she'll put it on and it's like, it's really good. I can really hear the imagination, the creativity and the rebelliousness and everything. But I'm still shocked. I can't help it, because, like, I'm in a different time in my life where I don't have friends who talk like that to my face. So when it comes on, you know what I mean? I feel like, whoa! Like so it's just the different contexts at different times of your life.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Is there any music that you're like, "Oh, this is shit. I don't like this kind of music"? Or do you respect all kinds of music?
I wouldn't say like that. Like, when I think about music, I think I'm trying to spend more time listening without having an opinion about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because even just in the sense that, okay, we're in show business, right? We're in a landscape of entertainment. It's interesting even just to hear what's going on. So you don't have to be a big moral judge of it. It's go, okay, this is popular. That's interesting. That has these qualities. That, but I can say overall that it doesn't speak to me personally when music is so heavily produced that the vulnerability of the artist is completely lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of pop music is produced in a way, and I can still admire the production, but it's almost like I've lost contact with the singer or the writer. And it's like, I want to feel them. I want to feel like, who is this person? And I can't feel it because there's like a team of like...
It's like having too many filters on a photo.
I'd say it's auto-tune's probably part of
that. That's right. And it's like, you'll find a singer, say, who's like a 17-year-old girl who's like full of this raw creativity and passion and talent. And then you can like hear the eight men in their 30s and 40s in the room.
Yeah.
That are making decisions that she wouldn't necessarily make.
Right.
And to me, that is just a turnoff artistically.
Right.
So I don't like listen to that for pleasure, but I still listen because I'm interested in what's happening.
The critical ear, essentially. Yeah. So you're 10 years old. You're like, I want to be in a rock band. Do you pick up, do you start learning music? What's the next step for you?
Yeah, well, like, I think from 8 to 10, I did the mandatory 2 Jewish years of piano.
Oh, I did that.
Piano, yes.
Yeah. And then I think at about 10, I started playing the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And at 13, I really had a mission statement for my bar mitzvah, and that was pooling the money from my grandparents' friends and everything and buying an electric guitar.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow, nice.
And I did it, and...
That's the first Kickstarter.
Yeah, that was the first Kickstarter.
Bar mitzvah. Did you get a Stratocaster?
No, I actually got a Gibson Les Paul.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
That promptly got stolen from one of our first shows.
They stole the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Oh, the bar mitzvah guitar, like that one. That's a special guitar.
But it's funny because I didn't, you know, I was looking at this Tascam recorder you have here, and it was reminding me that what I did was, I've always had a very kind of analytical mind that enjoys patterns and enjoys sort of building complex things, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something I've come to be able to articulate about myself. I wouldn't be able to back then, but I went, okay, I want to be standing on a stage playing music. What does that involve? It seems like it involves a record deal.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that involve? That involves making demos. So I found this music magazine where it had the instructions in the back on how to make your first demo.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
And it was things like, you know, get some kind of a recorder. Like I had an early version of what you have here, Tascam 244. It was really terrible.
A little four-track.
Kind of like Craigslist type thing we had in Sydney.
I probably had a tape deck.
Yeah, a little tape. He had special tapes for it. But it said, once you record it, take a photo of your band.
What?
And photocopy copies and write a thing called a bio.
Mm-hmm.
And get all your record covers and copy the addresses down of all the labels. And I just literally followed a checklist.
It's like the WikiHow.
Yeah, it was like, this is how you do it. It's like, start a band for dummies.
Right.
And funnily enough, you know, I liked a lot of, at the time, then underground, like Australian music and stuff. So the labels weren't, it wasn't like there was such a barrier for communication. They might not sign you, but you could probably get your call.
And I
always remember like everyone hated it because it was crazy because what it sounded like was to me at the time, you know, when you start things, you're totally delusional.
Yeah.
Like to me, it sounded like Appetite for Destruction or The Wall or Nevermind or something. Like it sounded huge. What it actually sounded like was sort of like The Shags meets Daniel Johnston meets like just like a lunatic, you know, with people that couldn't play instruments. I mean, it sounded like insane. But luckily at the time, there was kind of a cultural shift towards lo-fi music and weirdos like me making unlistenable music in their bedrooms.
Yeah.
And so one of these labels, I remember I called, it was Waterfront Records. I called them, I said, hey, this is Ben from Noise Addict. That was my band's name. Mm-hmm. I was like, did you get our demo? And he said, Ben, your tape stood out like dog's balls. And from then on, things kind of went from there. I actually got signed to that label.
That is amazing. And you're 14
when you do
this. That's
like the cover letter I sent.
Yeah, exactly. The one that you talked about last week. You're 14. You say, what, do you do the U2 thing and put up a sign at school? Like, how do you get the rest of your...
No, I didn't even... My friends... I wanted a bass player and a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew there was one of my friends who played guitar had a thing called a Zoom pedal. They still make Zoom pedals, but this was like an early one. And I knew it had a bass setting on it. So I said to him, do you want to play bass? It'll just be guitar through the Zoom.
Interesting.
And he was like, I don't play bass. I was like, it's easy. You just play the bottom note of each of your chords. And he was like, okay. And then my other friend, I knew his older brother played drums.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew he had a drum kit. So I said, do you want to play drums? He'd never played them before. And that was my band. I had it then.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And what kind of was a pretty successful venture.
Well, everything is, you know, seed planting. Like when you think about the long game of a career.
Yeah.
Like you may have a flashy debutante moment when you come in, which, you know, we sort of had. Like it was like like Dazed and Confused on the Face and NME, like all these magazines going, whoa, weirdo, lo-fi
right.
music out of Australia. And like, it sort of had like a cool moment.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I'm not particularly convinced that one way of beginning the journey is any better than any other way.
Right.
Like, there's an argument to be made that had we been able to continue in anonymity for some time, it might have been artistically better.
Right.
I probably a little too early became aware of people's reactions.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I was really grateful. Like, it sort of suddenly I went, ooh. It's like that beginner's luck. Like, right. I was like, ooh, that works. But you hear comedians talk about it, people like the first moment, yeah. they go, huh. Okay, something's happening
it
here.
Takes, yeah. I always say it takes one person to tell, well, as far as comedy writing, it takes one person who you respect to tell you you're funny to have, like, the confidence, like, oh, I'm great, and you're going to keep going, and you're going to fail, but that one person told you you're funny, and it's going to give you that confidence to, like, I got something.
Yeah.
It's rough, and it's maybe, like, hidden behind something, but I got it deep down. Yeah. And I think part of it, being any creative, it's, like, having really good taste. Like, you knew you had good taste in music. You knew, I think... I think no believing in like, oh, I know what good music is enough to propel you to just keep going, and even if you suck at the time.
Yeah, well, like, I think what I believed in was that in the way music was going, and my understanding of punk music and underground mm-hmm. music was that attitude was more important than ability.
Yeah.
And I knew I had willpower. I had like a really fierce sense of kind of chutzpah.
Yeah.
Like, I can do this, you know? And truly, a large portion of being effective in the world is having the guts to try.
It's true.
So yeah. I knew I had that.
Yeah. You know? Looking back on that music, are you, would you say you're proud of it? Is there any of it that makes you, like, cringe? Or, like, or are you like, no, even if it isn't, like, you know, what I am now, it's the stepping stones.
It was my seeds.
Well, it's hard to, like, it's hard for me to even to... articulate it because, you know, I'm going to be 40 this year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 26 years I've been making records for.
Wow.
So honestly, it's like my whole life I've been making music. So to saying to me, like, how do you feel about your early music? It's almost like saying, how do you feel about having been 14?
Right.
Right.
Like, it was good. There's bad
things. Awesome, that's actually a very healthy attitude, I think, yeah. in a sense, because you're like, well, that was my 14. That's what I did at 14. So I'm proud of that. 40. You don't look back and go, oh, shit. I didn't like how I sounded. And it, you know, that, I think that's actually really admirable.
Yeah.
Well, rock stars, you know, like when you listen to, like, say, even the most ridiculous, like Oasis, say,
mm-hmm.
like you know, like it's almost it's comedic how arrogant they are. But rock stars in their swagger, they also there's like a valuable lesson in the amount that they get off on what they were able to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, they're psyched. Like, if you ask Noel Gallagher, like, are you sad about not being as big as Oasis? He's like, I was there, man. I had it. I lived it. And for me, like, I have a degree of that I look back on. It's easy to criticize and it's easy to find the holes. But at the end of the day, at 14 years old, to find the courage to, without the skill and without any of it, to just... raise your hand and go, I'm up for it.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm really impressed with myself for that.
Yeah, no, listen, I'll tell you what I was doing at 14. It certainly wasn't, you know, something as creative or having the balls to go, like, even think that I could get signed by anything for, you know, like, that's, to me, that's remarkable.
It's very,
like,
ballsy.
I love when people have that, like, when they're young and have that foresight, like, yeah. know what they want to do. I'm 43 now. It took me, you know, 30 years to figure out what I want to do. And, like, for me, it's always fascinating when people are like, oh, no, I want to do this. And not only did I want to do this, I followed that dream and went for it and was a success.
Well, obviously. It's complicated, though, because in a way, yes, that side of it, right? I knew I wanted to make music. But the journey you took, it's, like, not dissimilar because I've had to figure out new reasons for it as I've matured.
Right.
So even though the form hasn't changed that much, at the end of the day, I sit down with my guitar or the piano, write a song, I write some lyrics on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
My reasons for doing it have shifted and my attitude to it. And it's like, you can't get stuck. using 14-year-old reasons
right.
for wanting to do something. So there's still the journey
right.
of becoming an adult, becoming a man, like going like, okay, mm-hmm. where do I stand as an artist 26 years into my career?
Right.
What are my reasons? What's making me do this?
It can't just be trying to get girls.
Yeah, I got one.
I was 14.
I got one. I'm married.
Success. Let's figure out a good reason to. Oh, well, I have to sustain the family. That's a good reason too as well. Well, so you spent 3 years in that band, is that correct?
Well, that band even, it's like, I don't know exactly what it was. It took different forms. Mm-hmm. And are we going to...
Yeah, we can go into it. So do you know my cousin was in his band?
No.
So he was our second drummer.
Oh, wow. It's like a Spinal Tap
thing? And he was a major, he was like a step forward. Like, that's, okay, this is like kind of interesting to talk about because part of having someone with a big vision, even at a young age, but it's continual, is continually trying to up-level the quality of what you're doing.
Absolutely.
And it's quite heartbreaking
yeah.
that involves letting go of certain relationships. And mm-hmm. I think that's why creative people sometimes get a reputation for ruthlessness, that they like, oh, you don't care, you can just leave a relationship, whatever. But
yeah.
if you're following this inspiration, you want to do it, it's like you don't have a choice. Like, you can't force everyone to come with you.
Yeah.
You have to find the people that want to go with you to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, interestingly, like, her cousin, it was a beautiful thing because he brought our band up. He was a drummer. So, we had the guy whose brother was a drummer.
Right.
And we took it as far as we could. And then we got a drummer.
A real drummer.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like a drum.
And it was... I didn't know this until yesterday or today. She
Are
said,
you serious?
Yeah. I mean, my cousin, they're three brothers, and I'm closest to Joel because he's the youngest, and we always talk, and he's lived in, like, he's just been in my house, and ever since my parents died, he's been, like, super close to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he posted something on Facebook that he was like, oh, me and Ben Lee at this thing. And I was like, oh, yes, I think you're the one that told me that you knew them. So I texted him. I'm like, hey, how'd you know Ben? And he's like, oh, and then he just sent me the link, the Wikipedia link to Noise Addict.
That's so funny.
And I look at the band members. I'm like, of course he is.
Yeah.
Of course there he is.
How important is it now, looking back on it, like being a trained musician, knowing how to read music? Do you think that's important for a musician or is it not that important?
It's something I'm increasingly interested in.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I'm learning a lot about chords and voicings and like more of the theory side.
Yeah.
I mean, the question even needs to be qualified. Do you mean to have a career in music or do you mean to understand music?
Well, look, there have been plenty of people, like, you know, I'm a big Howard Stern fan. He has bands on a show all the time and I hear them go, no, we don't even read music. No, I don't know. I just fiddle with the guitar and that's how I make my music.
But my friend went to school with Lin-Manuel Miranda mm-hmm. and he's like super, like, he knows music.
Yeah.
Front to back.
Mm-hmm.
He knows, like, the history of why things are the way they are. Like, that nothing really necessarily to do with the music itself,
yeah.
but that he just, like, knows it. And he's, like, really into the history of it and all that stuff. But, like, some people have no idea.
Right.
You know what I'd probably say? That, like, if you have raw music, like, talent in your blood, you can build a career or an art form or something without music theory.
Right.
But no one gets worse if they have that raw thing by learning the music theory.
Yeah.
Like, it just gives you more tools, more colors, more ways to use the palette.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do think there's also a lot of people that have a huge foundation in theory, but aren't in contact with their artistic vision.
Right.
And then it just becomes technical. And that's, I think, what people associate with it. It's like a bit boring or something.
I feel that way about filmmaking. Like, some people don't go to film school.
Right.
Never went to film school a day in their life, dropped out of high school, and then they become directors and they become, you know, big filmmakers. A lot of people I know, if you look at the screenwriters, for example, that won this year or that were nominated for Oscars, about half of them went to school that had something to do with screenwriting. The rest just stumbled upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's not a bad thing to go to film school, but if you have it in you to be a screenwriter or any kind of writer, then you're going to do it, you know, and it's really like an accent. Like, it brings out the flavor.
Yeah, and sooner or later, you're going to get interested. Like, this piece of, not to focus on this gear sitting on the table.
I wish
the audience
could see it,
but this Tascam,
I'll take a picture for
this Tascam recorder, there's no way you could say that by learning more about how to use this, it's going to make the podcast worse.
You're absolutely right.
It can only make it better,
right?
It could get 100%. You a slightly better tone, slightly better. So sooner or later, I think every musician gets more curious about why. Like, what I find with the guitar, say, is there's things I do intuitively that they make my body feel good, and I like the sound of certain combinations of notes. What I'm starting to get interested in is why. Because it's not, I'm not random. I am, maybe think I'm putting two random notes together, but they have a relationship throughout the history of Western music.
Right.
That it's interesting to know why. And I think as we become more sophisticated in our craft, in whatever our craft is, we get curious. We want to know, why do certain things work the way they work? And I think it only makes you better.
Then do you ever look back at your own music and you're like, oh, that's where I kind of took that from, this kind of music or from this song? Does that ever, like,
yeah, but I do, I also do that intentionally sometimes. Like, I'll like the feeling that I get from another artist, and I'll start sort of reverse engineering it, like going, how could I do something like, and the funny thing is it never sounds like the thing you set out to do,
right?
So it's actually quite a good way to inspire yourself. Go, oh, what if I wrote a song like All I Want to Do Is Have Some Fun, but sure, I guarantee you my version of that's not going to sound like that.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, I think that's a really great tool.
So let's talk a little bit about some failures you had early on. So you got a record label. That was great. Did they just offer you a record deal right away? What happened?
Yeah, it was very minimal. And I was really lucky in that there were two bands at that time, Sonic Youth and the Beastie Boys, that were both very, like, tastemaker, very influential band. So, and they both had labels, and Thurston from Sonic Youth and Mike D from the Beasties wanted to put out my music. And it was like, with that stamp of approval, it opened up doors to meeting a lot of different people and people getting interested in what I do. And another big victory influence at that time was this guy named Brad Wood, who I've continued to make records with. He's mixing the musical album
now.
He'd done Liz Phair's album, Exile in Guyville, and I really liked that album and thought the production would suit what I was doing acoustically. So he also, it was this sort of, the right people were around, right?
Good.
But so that was this initial wave. And then, so I made a solo record, I made a Noise Addict record, and they were all just, it was very like Spin Magazine, like five stars, like everything.
Wow.
Like, and then I was like, okay, my next record, I'm going to become more folky and more grown up. And I listened to like Loudon Wainwright, who I liked a lot, and Bob Dylan. And I wrote this kind of, I was 18, and I wrote this record that, interestingly, in retrospect, I mean, it's a little hard to separate the criticisms from how I feel about it.
Sure.
In some ways, I think the critics had a point that I was trying to sound older, wiser, more damaged, more like I was trying to be
like
a
18-year-old to me.
Right, but I'd come off a track record of just effortlessly cool.
Right.
And suddenly you could see the strings and you could see the cracks.
Interesting.
And it was like basically got bad reviews across the board.
Oh, no.
I was 18. I just got out of high school. And I was like, oh, this is the other side of it. Like, I felt it. Now,
it's like reading the YouTube comments for the first time.
Yeah.
You were living in New York at 18.
No, at that point, I'd finished high school and I sort of came out here and then ended up going to New York a few months later. But I toured a lot on that record, but it was kind of like it opened up this pain, I would say, that I didn't realize how much I had valued the positive sort of validation and reinforcement that had come from the first part of my career, because it had been so positive that until it like turned on me and I felt like empty, I was like, oh my gosh, what am I? It's like I didn't realize at that point my center wasn't that strong.
Does that make you consider the album a failure in your mind because of how other people view it, or no?
I consider it, well, interestingly, a lot of the relationships formed around that have continued into my present day life. Musicians I met, people I, in that one, in the first, I made that album over 2 weeks. In that 2 week period, I met Claire Danes, who I then went out with for 6.5 years.
Right.
And I met Ione, my wife now.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I met
weird.
Them both in that 2 week period. So
how
could I consider that period of life a failure, in that it like, it shaped my love life, my understanding of relationships and women.
It was your future.
It all happened in that period, right?
Yeah.
Artistically, the reason I think that record is a failure is because it's like if your audience is aware of what you need and you want, mm-hmm. they don't have the freedom to actually react to the music,
mm.
right? Mm-hmm. It becomes about your needs. Right. And you enter into a sort of codependent relationship with the audience. And I think in that record, I was so desperate to get a certain type of reaction, to be looked at a certain way, mm-hmm. that it actually robbed the audience of an opportunity to have a personal and just musical experience.
Yeah.
So my needs, and at 18, you leave high school, everyone's like that. So I also can contextualize it around the time of my life. But mainly, I think it's a failure because I can hear too heavily what I wanted out of it. You know right. what I mean? It's
yeah.
like, it's like, just make some music and let's let it be in there, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'm always curious about the whole solo thing. Like, when you go solo, first of all, you're 18. You know, are you confident that you're going to do well? You're in a band with at least one of your friends, right? And if you're going solo, there, I feel like there has to be some sort of animosity, jealousy.
Well,
like...
no, but I started, I made my first solo record at 15 okay. while the band was still together. Yes, but okay, look.
But even so, there has to be something like, oh, well, he thinks he's better than us.
But you got to remember, our band was based on being delusional. So the band members, yes, felt some resentment, mm-hmm. but they were also totally delusional in the fact that they were career musicians. Just based on the fact that none of them went on to be musicians.
Right.
So yeah. if that's all it takes, a singer going solo, for you to like give up the dream of music at 18, you're not
you
a musician.
You were not a musician. So, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, Joel's a huge music fan, and he like when I need like advice for like what's hip right now, he mm-hmm. knows. He's like diehard and like, yeah, like I'll trust him with music advice
yeah.
and music like critique, but he's not doing that now.
Yeah,
yeah. It's like, so if that's in you, yeah. it is so in you, so profoundly. And I knew that's what we were talking about a minute ago, that the you have to be aware enough of, you know, just the vibe
yeah.
of what's happening in your life to know when it's time to move on.
Right.
Otherwise, you become that. And this is something I'm actually really proud of in my life and in my career, that there aren't that many people from my scene 26 years ago that have been able to keep rolling with the changes and everything, with their own life changes
yeah.
and are still just making the art they want to make. And I think it's partly because for whatever reason, I've had this ability to not be nostalgic. And if something doesn't work, I just try it a different way.
Hmm.
I don't mm-hmm. beat myself up. I don't worry about it too much. I just go, it's got to work another way then. And
right.
I try another way.
So, huh.
So failures are, you know, I sort of look, it's weird, maybe everyone feels like this, but I sort of feel like in a way, my whole career is a failure because,
oh, no.
no, because I never achieved the fantasy and the illusion that I wanted when I entered music, right?
Yeah.
Like I wanted to be like Motley Crue. I wanted to be like Kurt Cobain. I wanted to be like the man, the biggest, the one, the special
right.
music that everyone loves. That, like, at this point in my life, that's not been my destiny. I've made music that has meant a lot
mm-hmm.
to a sort of limited number of people, but it's been meaningful enough and to enough people that it's kept me afloat
yeah.
and kept me going with opportunities. But you can only judge it. That's kind of what I meant. The reason has to keep changing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right. I mean, if you look back on it now, isn't that better than being an Axl Rose who kind of, you know, some people are shooting stars that, you know, they burn out so quickly. You're a star that gets to, you know, you get to ride it out across the whole sky. And that's probably more special.
I'm so grateful that I did not get to write my life story because I would have written something much more boring.
Yeah.
Much more successful. And something that I think would have imprisoned me in ways I can't even begin to imagine. Hmm. I think what I've actually ended up with through the sort of dexterity of learning how to move through situations and roll with it and survive is I've ended up like agile.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is something that like every project I do is different. Everyone kind of, even people that don't like my work or don't know about it, they kind of, if they're peripherally aware of me, they're like, he's always up to interesting things.
Yeah.
That's cool. I that like that.
Me.
I like being that guy.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't need you to love I don't need you to love every piece of work I do. I just like that, like, it's almost like the training happens
yeah.
by doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
When you have a song, because you have songs that are, you have tons of soundtracks that your songs are a part of, but, like, I think of, like, there's Something About Mary. Is that like a, is that a huge thing for you, or does it not change your life?
I don't know if it changed my life. What was interesting about that song was off the record I'm talking about, mm-hmm. but Something to Remember Me By.
Yeah.
That really was the first one where like I felt, ooh, people did not like that. But what was interesting about it was the Farrelly brothers got it. They took the song. Mm-hmm. They extricated it from my drama and my narrative around what that album was. And they aesthetically used it in a scene where Cameron Diaz first comes in on roller skates. Mm-hmm. And it works.
Yeah.
And it was this connection. It's like a multimedia connection, right? Yeah. It's the idea that like music, I like the way music, film, television, art, installation, I like the way all this stuff interacts. Mm-hmm. And those experiences were some of the clues I got.
Yeah.
That for whatever reason, people liked putting my songs in things to heighten a certain atmosphere dramatically. And it's not because the music was so complex. It's just like the energy I made it with, or like the tenderness or something, it supported these things. So that kind of, I remember that specifically as going, huh, there's some reason, like the Farrelly brothers thought, this is the moment we want to introduce our leading lady with this little riff. It made me consider things. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's super cool. And do you ever write a song or like put out a song you're like, oh, I'm not so sure about it. And then it goes into a soundtrack and you're like, oh, that's what it was for. Like,
well, you sort of hope that, you know. Yeah. But I wouldn't limit that to soundtracks. I think that is something that happens when people write me little messages, you know, on social media or... Sometimes they will create a context for the meaning of the song or why it's important in their life.
Yeah.
That is something I would not have. I've had people thank me profoundly for songs that I'd forgotten I'd written.
Hmm.
And suddenly I was like, oh, that was like kind of important in a small way that touched them.
Yeah.
And so I, it's another example of just the ways that your art over time, over playing the long game.
Yeah.
Begins to find what its purpose is, I guess.
You made me think of, and I'm sorry, I hope I didn't cut you off. Have you ever seen the documentary Imagine?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay, I remember from years
ago. The guy shows up on the
That's day. Exactly what I was thinking. So a fan, for those of you who don't know, a fan shows up to, it's about John Lennon, fan shows up to his house. And
he's like
John
on Lennon, acid or something.
Yeah, best way to describe him, he kind of looks like a bum a little bit.
Right.
John Lennon lets him in, and he starts talking to him about how John had written all these songs for him. And literally John's like, no, this is about this. And this is about, he's like, no, it can't be. This is about my life. And like, I mean, to me, that's kind of what you were saying, where it's like you do, some songs do hit you. As a matter of fact, like I said, I'm a huge Pearl Jam fan. I had a little rough patch in my life and a song kind of like, it was the right words and the right music at the right place that it like blew me away. And still now it's something, it's a part of the soundtrack of my life.
Yeah,
it's like, okay,
yeah.
This song change things for me.
My editor at Playboy, when I worked for Playboy, when I was a columnist, I had a breakup and sent me, like, he's like, here's a mixtape of, like on Spotify.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know, this is dumb. And all those songs really helped me.
Yeah.
And now every time I'm sad about, like, some asshole, they make me feel so much better. And it's like Pavlov with the dog now. When I hear one of those songs from that stupid mixtape, I'm like, oh, that's, I feel better and
it's
peppy.
The fuck those assholes mix. On
but
the
I was thinking, because I'm like, I'm currently writing a movie, and a lot of times my writing partner and I will listen to a song and that will kind of inspire us for like a character in a scene. And I'm not sure we'll necessarily want to use that song in the film, but it does kind of like, oh, this is the kind of vibe, like this is the attitude they're coming into the scene with. And it's just, it's beautiful when it like all works, but like you never know what someone will, how they'll interpret it. And it's really, it's so interesting to see it with like, with movies and TV. That's
I think
why.
That's part of actually the talent of songwriting, not the, just the formal aspects of structure or harmony or anything, but can you write something that is opaque enough so that people can project their own experience onto it?
Yeah.
Because if you make it so highly personalized, look, there's times when it happens, like Courtney Barnett, say, she's an Australian songwriter, she can write with an immense amount of detail that could only be in her life.
Right.
Yet still, there's something I know about my life when I listen to it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is her attention to detail. It makes me pay attention to the details in my life or to my passing thoughts or to the way I use words. And I think part of what makes songs work is that they're mirrors.
Right.
You know, they might have an energy to them, but they also let us hear what we need to hear in them. And that's a quite mysterious part of it.
I had a screenwriting teacher when I first kind of started. She used to give us like a sheet for each character. And part of the question, there were some of the questions that we were like, what am I going to need this for? Like, what's their favorite food? But a lot of them was like, what's their favorite song? What's like the album they had when they were kids that like they listened to till like, you know, like they were, their ears were bleeding, and like what kind of song embodies them when they come into like a room. And that was the most, that was like really what like, oh, now I get this character. Like this song matches this character, and it's so powerful.
Did you find that was more about, what percentage would you say that was about what the lyrics said?
Oh,
and what
good
was
question.
About the feeling of the song?
I want to say 50-50, but for like example, I'm writing right now, my great aunt was a Holocaust resistance fighter. So we're writing a movie about the Jewish resistance, and it's a Holocaust movie, but it's fun. And it's about women punching
Nazis.
I've
never heard anyone say that before. Okay.
But it's about women.
Did Jerry Lewis do a Holocaust movie that was supposed to be funny?
It's not funny. It's fun. It's like, it's a little bit like Inglourious Basterds meets with women. Okay. But I told my writing partner, and I decided early, because we wanted to be very stylized, and we really want the music to be excellent and a big part of the movie. And we're writing literally every scene, like what song matches. And we're doing a lot of like songs from, and we want every song to be actually written after the war, not before. So it's everything. A lot of stuffs are like from rock from like the 70s and 60s. And we're like putting in a lot of T-Rex and stuff like that. And the lyrics,
T-Rex is a great example because the lyrics are sort of meaningless.
Exactly.
But the vibe of it is so big.
But the vibe is big. And for a lot of the scenes that we're doing, it's like, yeah, this is the vibe we're going into. But we were thinking in the beginning when we started writing, like, let's put some hip hop. And we started, and like some of the songs, yeah, this works. And then they start talking, and they're like, you know, these lyrics just don't match the message of our screen. Like, they're saying very misogynistic things, and here we are having women trying to like beat up a bunch of Nazis. It's not working out.
Well, this is so interesting to me because my little band Radner and Lee, like, we toured Brazil and Argentina earlier this year.
Yeah.
It was my first time playing there. I've played in non-English speaking countries before, but never in a way that connected this much. And the music, they really like it there. Like, we played to like 1,100 people in Sao Paulo singing every word to our songs, but they can't really speak English. They've just learnt it like phonetically.
Oh, wow.
And it led to Josh and I talking a lot about what type of music connects in non-English speaking cultures.
Yeah.
And with Coldplay, like, you can go see them anywhere in the world. I don't know what he's talking about, but I know the feeling is hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that feeling is, it goes beyond language.
Right.
Everywhere in the world, people need hope. And when they go to a Coldplay show, they're getting their dose of hope, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's just really interesting. Like, music, even the vocals, like, we're not talking about instrumental music. The voice is an instrument too.
Mm.
And even if it's singing words, I think Eddie Vedder's a great example.
Yeah.
I love how he sings. I don't think I could, I probably couldn't quote back half a dozen lyrics of his from you.
Yeah.
But his tone is so emotional and empowering. So all of this is like the science of music, you know, it's so interesting.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I really think it just depends. I went to, Edgar Wright had like a screening recently. He was doing this thing about music and film, and he was showing his favorite movies and the songs that went with them. So he put like American Werewolf in Paris, and oh no, in London. And I don't know if you know that scene, but have you seen that movie? You should all see that, because the scene where he turns into a werewolf, there's like a song playing in the background, and it's
Werewolf
about five
of London. No, I'm sorry.
American Werewolf in London.
Oh, the song Werewolves of London. I was making.
Oh no, but it's like 5 minutes. There's no dialogue. He's turning into a, like his hands are like getting like claws on them. He's like becoming a werewolf, and there's just the song, and it's so but it fits so perfectly. And just like, and you don't, the lyrics are beyond it. It's not about that. It's about that feeling. And there's nothing else to cover besides the fact that he's turning into a werewolf. There's no dialogue. Like, you're just with the music and this weird change that's happening. And that was just so fascinating. But, like, he was saying how, like, other songs, like Baby Driver, he wrote with, like, a clear list of, like, songs he had to have on there. And every piece of dialogue in Baby Driver was, like, matching a beat.
Right.
Which was, and if you look at the script is actually very interesting if you're a songwriter, because the script is written in a way, he said it was a spec script when he wrote it, which looks that way, because I can see an exec reading it and being like, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I can't make this film. But now he's Edgar Wright, so of course they're going to make it.
Sure.
So, but if you read it, it's like, and then on this beat of this song, he says this. And it's, like, so interesting and fascinating. And he really deconstructed every note of every song he put in that movie. But, yeah, it's just kind of... It's fascinating how that can work.
Yeah.
It's weird that that's the... They don't speak English there in Sao Paulo.
No, I mean, they do speak a bit. Yeah. I just mean, in general, they speak Portuguese.
Right.
So it's, like, on a daily level, you know.
So but, you didn't say Brazilian?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Because people do
Portuguese
that,
like, is one of my favorite languages.
But, you know, it did make me think, though, like... Is it just that it's a small subset so that there is something like this that exists in the United States where there's 1,000 people that would go see some Brazilian band? Like, I just feel like maybe we're so insulated and stuff. Yeah. I don't feel like we embrace other countries' music like other countries may embrace our music.
Well, that's, I mean, is, I think you're touching on a larger issue about American culture.
Yeah. Right.
And look, I moved to America from Australia because I... was seduced by American culture and by the attitude of the imperialist attitude of like, we make the best stuff, we listen to our own stuff,
we go to Costco.
But for sure, like, as we mature, whether it's musically or culturally, we actually, like, realize that it's nourishing and we thrive by opening to foreign ideas.
Are awards important? You won multiple ARIA awards, which are essentially Grammys, right?
Yeah.
Is that important to you?
Look, it's one of those things where I've started realizing, you know, I have a little home studio at home and I've always just had pictures that I like up. And I started realizing, I produced Jill Sobule, who's this great songwriter, produced her new record in the studio. And I started having more people I don't know coming in.
Hmm.
And I was like, oh, I sort of get it. Like, why people put their awards and stuff up in a studio.
Yeah.
Because it basically is saying, like, don't worry.
Right.
I've got this. Relax.
It's like a doctor having
a... Exactly. And I now have my awards and some gold records and things up in the studio. And I just look at it as, like, it's just part of language almost. It's like a visual language.
Mm-hmm.
You come in here, this is a person who you can trust that I'm not going to screw you over. I'm not going to make you look bad.
Right.
I know what I'm doing. It's been recognized, quote unquote, whatever that means.
Right.
So I don't think of it beyond that. I never... Not once have a moment. It's funny. I don't know if this is embarrassing. I actually like this story. Do you know who Juliana Hatfield is?
Well, I know.
She's a great singer-songwriter from the 90s. But we did a tour together, and there was, like, very few people at one of the shows. There was a co-headline. And I came backstage, and she was just going. She was just saying to herself, I sold out Roseland. I sold out Roseland. I sold out Roseland. Like, it was a mantra that in some ways those types of accomplishments... You can. It's like Noel Gallagher going, we did it, man.
Right.
I've already done it. I've sold out Roseline. Even if no one comes to the rest of my shows,
sure.
I've had that. So it means something, but honestly, I am so forward-focused. I just think it's a waste of energy and time. I'd rather deal with what's in front of me.
Do you have one of those venues that you're most proud of playing?
No.
Or a favorite one?
No.
What's the best kind of venue to play, though? Is it a big stadium? Is it...
As I get older, it's good sound.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because what I'm trying to protect now is my experience. Because what I'm realizing is that, like, that's what I get to keep.
Yeah.
You know, the crowds are going to come and go. Like, you'll go through times where your work is in fashion, out of fashion. But if you can get lost on stage in the playing of the music, it's all good.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to really go prioritize that in terms of taking the extra time at soundcheck, even in venue selection. If I know somewhere's cool, but... it has really bad sound, I go, let's skip that this time.
Oh, really?
Let's play somewhere. Good. Let's choose the other place in favor of it that has a better sound.
It's kind of like stand-up comics. Sometimes they won't do every venue.
Yeah, otherwise you end up being just like, it's like you're just like phoning it in. Like you're on duty doing your act.
Yeah.
But you're not you don't get lost.
Yeah.
You know?
Go ahead.
I remember, this is a weird story that I just remembered. When I was 15, I entered this, like, at the time, there was a radio station in LA. I think I was 16. Yeah. I was in high school. And my friend and I won tickets to see you and Ben Folds at this hotel. And we saw you at this hotel.
Oh, on the roof of, was it like the...
The Lowe's on, like, Highland.
That was fun. It was like Indy 103.
It was Indy 103.1, yeah. And I won tickets to that.
And
really?
And Ben Folds was there, yeah.
What was the reggae guy? He was called...
Jonesy?
Like no. He was like a white... Jamaican guy.
Snow.
Not Naked Dave. It was Wayne. Native Wayne. He was there.
Yeah.
He was emceeing it.
Yeah. It was the weirdest venue I was ever at. And I was like, I wonder if they want to, like.
Well, it's one of those. That was a radio schmooze thing. Like,
yeah.
The reality is, if you have a chance of getting into that world and being played on the radio, you shake hands, you show up, you do right. their events. I don't have an objection to that. That's just like the game. It's like, I can't complain. If you want to get on the radio, you go there and you do it.
I just thought it was cool that, like, oh, there's a piano, we're by the pool.
That's the whole thing, right?
But as a kid living in LA, you know, I was dragged to, like, the Troubadour and, like, all these, like, cool, like, venues. And, yeah, it's just, you know, I was like, this is odd. I wonder if they enjoy doing this.
I think I remember that being kind of fun.
As a songwriter, a composer, is there a soundtrack kind of like always going in your head? Is there always music playing in your head?
That's really tough for me to answer, because I would answer it, there's always music playing in the universe. I don't know if that's my head.
It might be, but it is. To me, it
feels like there is sound and vibration and harmony and dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
This is a musical experience. These are the three voices interacting.
Right.
So I may be perceiving that more as music, whereas if you talk to a visual artist, they might see color interaction. Mm-hmm. But I don't see that as particularly like I have some like crazy thing going on in my head.
You're not in the shower listening to a radio station in your head, like there's music going. I've heard artists describe that they kind of pull it. Do you walk around, you ever think of a song and like just sing it into your phone?
Yeah.
And that...
I'm dying to listen to your phone.
Sometimes.
And then sometimes you're like, what the hell is this thing?
I mean, okay, so this is like a little more subtle, but this is part of sort of the creative journey too, is that I've kind of learned a little bit more about the seduction with ideas. And it feels like there's an earlier stage where you like obsessively write everything down and record everything out of fear you're going to lose it,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's a validity to it. But you also sometimes end up letting ideas through. It's almost like you'll like go home with anyone from the bar.
Right.
You know what I mean? Whereas now I'm a bit more like, yeah, you got something for me? All right, come on, keep knocking. Let's see if you're serious.
Right. And if you're like, that good...
I play a little hard to get with them, and it's almost like I resist them a little.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I've sort of come to realize that, like, ideas, it's like people. There's power dynamics.
Yeah.
And if you become the kind of person that's like a slave, that's open to everything, you'll just be bombarded with ideas thinking everyone is brilliant.
Right.
And, all my ideas are incredible. And I sort of now feel more like... it's a dance and it's a seduction and I want the quality to come through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I think more like
that. Do you just know when something's good or is it like you call your wife in to listen to it? Or somebody send it to a friend, you send it to another musician, or you just know?
Well, it's complicated because you're using the word good in the question as if that has an absolute meaning.
Right, because what you think could be brilliant, like I said a couple weeks ago, the tweet that I thought was going to get me a writing job got 3 retweets. Like, it's that kind
of
thing.
But it may have played a role in your development and your creative process that is incredibly important. And you might be sensing its importance, but then trying to, like... turn that into like quantify it, like turn it into numbers before its moment. Like what you might really have been perceiving in that moment, I don't know the tweet you're talking about, but you might have begun to use your mind in a new way to perceive something funny or insightful in a way that you haven't done before.
Mm-hmm.
So other people are going like, oh, that's not the greatest joke I've ever heard, and they just scroll past it.
Right.
So you're like, can't you see what's happening? There is a new stroke of genius being born in my mind. And they'll see it down the line when it takes a more mature form, probably.
Yeah.
But so I'm sort of like reluctant to say it's only good if people recognize it, because there's developmental things. Like I said, Something to Remember Me By, that record got panned but I kind of met the two most influential women in my adult life mm-hmm. within a two-week period.
Yeah.
That was an important period, you know?
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, I do just want to mention again that your wife is Ione Skye just because she's an icon. Like, she's a, you know, say anything. It's just, it's like, now, let me ask you this. I'm not going to make this about your wife at all, but
yeah,
when you are in a movie that is that iconic, is that like, does it get annoying when people recognize you for that the most? Does she, do you know? Is she like, okay, like,
I don't think
just
it's
like some other movie? Other
no, I don't think, I don't think at all. She's not annoyed or ungrateful or anything. I think she, for a long time, has aspired to create things of an equal or better, the opportunity, you know, mm-hmm. to work at that level. It's interesting now she's doing this show on HBO called Camping, the Lena Dunham, Jenny Connor show, the mm-hmm. new one, and she's working at such a high creative and comedic level that it's like she's been waiting for an opportunity like this.
That's
so great.
And it's not about feeling resentful of, oh, it's not like Radiohead with Creep.
Right.
Like, even you look at that band, and they've come around to playing it again. Because there seems like a period of, you go through like an initial resentment, mm-hmm. but then you kind of have gratitude. You're like, oh.
Didn't Oasis have that too, I feel?
Probably. Yeah. You're like, oh, that's how they got into us.
Yeah, they stopped playing Wonderwall, but then they had nothing else to play.
But you just want to keep having opportunities. It's more of that. I think as artists, I have always thought it's really funny, like when people win Oscars or Grammys or something, there's this very elaborate moment. But I think what's really happening in the mind of the person up there is like, they're going like, I'm going to get to keep working.
Yeah. Always...
I'll probably get offered some jobs.
Yeah.
I'll
I'll
be able to pay my mortgage.
That's the only reason I won an Emmy.
Yeah, artists are very utilitarian. We're like blue collar. Even at the most successful level, we think job to job.
Yeah.
We think of like, is our service in demand? Can mm-hmm. we work at a level of quality, you know?
Did you consider holding a boombox over your head when you proposed? Or would that have been like just too
over the
top? No, it's
enough, I think, enough. Like journalists and stuff have done it.
Right.
awful.
Real quick, let's talk about Bees for Beer.
Yeah.
So let's tell our audience the story.
Okay.
I know the story
because
I went to the launch party, which was so much fun. But
So about 8 years ago, I came across a book by Tom Robbins who wrote Jitterbug Perfume.
Yeah, he's Cowgirls a famous author.
Yeah, one of the great American authors. And it was a book called Bees for Beer. And I reached out to him and began the process of writing a musical with him based on this book. And it's a very odd project. It's about consciousness and psychedelics and childhood and innocence and transcendence. But we've come up with something that is really quite powerful. And it's interesting with musical theater because it's actually quite a conservative world. If you look at Broadway.
Yeah.
It's like six theaters.
Yeah.
You know, or eight theaters. Whatever it is, it's like it is a small world. So when you do something kind of subversive and outside the mainstream, it's good to find a back way into it, you know.
Yeah.
So what we decided was we did a workshop and stuff, and I said, look, what I know how to do is make an album. I know how to make a good album. Let's make an album of the songs, because that's how The Who got Tommy up.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
How Evita, Jesus Christ Superstar. Like,
sure.
It's a valid way of making an album. So we've made an album. It's got a great cast playing the roles on the record. It's Laura Silverman, Busy Phillips, Rose Byrne, Paul F. Tompkins, John Cryer, Belinda Carlisle.
Wow.
Great people.
Star-studded.
And at the moment, we're doing a Kickstarter that people can go to up until the end of the month and get T-shirts or signed books by Tom, everything. It's both about the... you know, the making of the album, the cost of that, but also about just spreading awareness around this because it creates momentum
mm-hmm.
for the thing to become an actual production. And I would just suggest people check it out because, you know, Tom is 86 now. This is potentially, if not his last major work he's going to participate in. These parts of our culture, these people that have put in the yards, you know, that have like worked... Mm-hmm. from inspiration and against the grain and with underground culture for years and years and years and years, they're a rarity and they have something to teach us.
Yeah.
And I really think this piece, it is about why do we search to for a expanded state of consciousness. And beer is sort of like a device in that, like a little girl looking at her dad going, why is he drinking beer?
Yeah.
But it is the most socially acceptable form of consciousness alteration. So I'd love people to check it out and support it. And I hope that we can make something up while Tom's around to see it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That will really celebrate him and his place in American creative culture.
And there's actually a link in the in the comment section, or whatever you want to call it, of this podcast.
We'll put that up so people can
link right up to it.
Brilliant.
Two more questions for you. One, what do you consider your biggest failure?
My biggest failure is, I've always been interested in philosophy and spirituality and self-examination. And for some time, I got quite into, if you say the occult, it makes people think of like witchcraft or something.
Right.
But really, like, you know, the Kabbalah, meditation, Christian Gnosticism, like all of this interesting.
Aleister Crowley?
Yeah, all of this like,
so yeah,
all of this interesting alternate psychology, mm-hmm. you know. And I think for a while it made me not, it sapped my fun and playfulness out of me. And I think as a parent, it made me a little severe for like about a 2-year period.
Yeah.
That more so than is my real nature. And I think particularly with my stepdaughter, I think it caused some damage in our relationship at a time when I think that if I could have had more levity and more, like, you know, when you're a teenager, everything's so heavy anyway.
Yeah.
And you kind of just want your parents to just like support you, tell you everything's going to be okay. And
yeah.
When you're studying, asking these big questions, like, what is the beginning of time? What is the end of human consciousness? What's the final goal? Everything can become very like weighty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I think my biggest failure has been a parenting failure, in that we're actually really good now, but it's required some real self-reflection on my part, seeing that I think I kind of let the side down by getting too caught up in my own yearning or my own questions instead of really like listening to what the people around me needed.
Do you read Behold a Pale Horse at that point?
I have not read that.
Okay.
What is that?
It's this big conspiracy theory book. Don't even bother.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why'd you bring it up?
Just because I thought maybe during part of it. Because I did, like, I've definitely researched that kind of stuff, and that book kind of came around. Because I was more like, a little more to the conspiracy theories, like aliens and stuff
like
that.
I'm shocked.
I do believe in aliens.
What?
I've seen an alien.
I don't even know you anymore.
That's a whole other story.
I think it's because I've always been interested in psychedelics. My inclination has been more towards other various internal states and realities, and it is a slippery slope because you go in and suddenly everything, all the lines get blurred, like things don't have hard edges anymore.
Right.
It's like, and I met a Kabbalah teacher once when I was probably 19 who said, don't even start looking at this, it'll ruin your life.
Huh.
He said, I regret ever opening a book. And
wow.
And I can sort of see how these things, it's easy to laugh at them as like outdated or antiquated, but they are art forms and they're poetry. And it's like, it takes your mind into places that you might not be mature enough to actually grapple
seductive.
With.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it really actually gives you respect for the people, because one of the things you just made me think of, The Art of War, have you ever read?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, think about that. Like, these people have been around so long, they turned war into an art. Like, that's, if you think about that, just like they turned fighting into an art. Like, that's fucking insane. Like, you have to really respect the culture to be able to, like, break shit down like that. At least I do. All right, last question for you. What is your favorite charity?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm not really one of those, like, desert island people that's like, these are my favorite records, this is my favorite.
Right.
So I don't have like a pat answer.
Okay.
But I will say I've worked quite a bit with a charity my friend started in Australia called A Sound Life.
Okay.
A Sound Life. And they try and bring yoga and music into hospitals and
lovely.
Areas of need.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of each time I'm in Australia, we'll go to the children's hospital and go ward to ward playing songs. And it's as much for the kids as it is for the parents.
Yeah.
Because the parents have been sitting there going through these, like, waiting and surgeries. And they just have this stress valve that needs to be released. And you see how bringing in some music and just entertaining them is really... So I've really had a great experience with
that. Okay, well, then I'm assuming there's a way to donate to them.
Yeah, the people find... I think it's like a soundlife.org or something.
Perfect.
Like
I'm going to find it. We're going to donate $100 in your name.
Awesome,
thank
man.
You so much.
Thank you.
And, of course, we're going to have a link for that as well in the show
so you can
summary
donate.
So you can donate yourself. We always do that on Failing Up.
Beautiful.
But, Ben, thank you so much for spending the time with us. We really appreciate it. Eden,
yes.
Thank you again.
Thank you for listening.
Donate to the Kickstarter so we can see this. Yeah.
Kickstarter, most important.
Yeah. Because well, I want to see this. I want to see this. Yeah. Like,
it'll happen. I'm getting a good feeling. Like people.
I told
like,
you in the beginning it's like lagged, but then it picks up for artist stuff. So it'll get there.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Bye.